Funny, I just realized that for 2 weeks in a row now, I'm going to start out by talking about our son. When Corby was in high school, he had to write a paper, and the paper had to be in the form of an argument. Those of you that have taken English classes understand, you know, those different types of writing that they require you to do. And, you know, you had to pick a topic and defend an argument, you know, make a point and defend the point, explain the logic and all that kinds of thing. And so Corb, being a relatively new Christian, decided that he would write this paper with the sort of, you know, secret, covert motive of convincing his teacher about the truth of Christianity. Teacher apparently was an unbeliever, or, you know, made it clear that he was an atheist or an agnostic or something. And so Corby was not only going to, you know, do the assignment and get the grade, but he thought he could persuade with his skills of argument, persuade this teacher that God is real, Jesus is real, and, you know, heaven and hell are real, and the whole story there. So he wrote this thing, and he let me read it, and it was really good. It was like 4 or 5 pages, you know, single-sided typed paper. And boy, he just, you know, he started in the beginning, and he didn't just recite Bible verses. He made a case. He was kind of into guys like apologists, like Chuck Missler, or who's that other fellow with the chrome hair? I can't think of his name now, but, you know, back in the whatever year that was, 80-something, he had gotten all these materials, and he just wrote this paper. It was a thing of beauty, and he thought, not only am I going to get an A, but this teacher is going to, like, come away believing, you know, the only logical conclusion that could possibly be reached is that you need to get your life right with God. You need to have your sin, accept the forgiveness of your sin that's already been provided, so that you can look forward to an eternity in paradise or heaven, whatever you want to call it, after this life is over. Well, didn't work. I don't know if he got an A or not. He did okay on the paper, but the teacher just wasn't going to believe, and I explained to, he was really disappointed. And I explained to Corby, I said, you know, the teacher, whatever his name was, you know, made up his mind long time ago, a long, long time ago, that he didn't believe and he wasn't gonna believe. And the, you know, the odds of your paper, anybody's book, anybody's sermon, anybody's message or talk, you know, at the coffee shop or whatever, the odds were just extremely, you know, against this guy changing his mind, because he'd already made up his mind. But I remember thinking, you know, I wonder what the, for this individual or for some other individual, what would the key be? You know, of all the things that they knew or thought they knew about Jesus, about Christian teaching, the gospel and doctrine and theology and all that, what would be the key? What's the one thing that they would need to know? You know, the piece of information that they would receive, you know, and suddenly go, oh, you know, I remember I had that aha moment. I was raised in a family where we went to church once in a while, and I went to vacation Bible school like we're about to have, and I knew all about popsicle stick crosses and macaroni arcs, and I'd, you know, been there and done that. And when I was about 28 years old, someone presented the gospel for the umpteenth time, and I remember it was a real aha experience, because that guy gave me a piece of information that I never had before. And it was now that I know that, you know, that key piece, now my heart is open, my mind has changed, and so the question comes down to, what do you need to know before you give your life completely over to Jesus Christ? Now, it's funny, you know, Chuck Missler says there's no such word as coincidence, or coincidence is not a kosher word, that's how he says it. And so yesterday, you know, I went through my notes again and read through the passage several times, and I'm thinking through this, you know, while Mary was at the women's retreat, which I forgot to show the pictures of. My bad. We'll do it, okay? Anyway, I'm home alone Saturday morning, and I'm going over the notes for today, and I got done, and I had, you know, a couple hours to kill, and Mary wasn't going to be home till after 3, and so I surfed through the channels, and I'd mowed the lawn the day before. I didn't have, you know, I was kind of free for a change, and And I came across that old movie. I saw it when it first came out. It was called Contact. Remember that? What's her name? Jodie Foster? Is that the gal's name? And, you know, she and Matthew McConaughey, is that how you say that? He plays a, I don't know if he's a priest, but he's some kind of religious guy. And she plays a scientist, and she receives signals from outer space, and the government builds this machine, and a terrorist, you know, a Christian, of course, kook, blows up the machine, but don't worry, they have a secret machine, and they go to the secret machine, and she gets in it, and she's strapped in this baby, and the thing goes off, and she travels through wormholes and black holes and all kinds of stuff, and has this experience with C. Her dead father, and you know, is this God? Is this heaven? Is this what? And she sees the whole thing, and then she comes back and she says, "How long was I gone?" And they say, "What do you mean?" "Well, how long was I gone?" And they said, You weren't gone at all. The thing fell, you know, the little capsule you were in went from here to here, and it took like that long, and the whole thing was over." And she says, "Well, no, I've traveled, and I had a conversation here, and I saw this place and the moons and the, you know, the planets, and it couldn't have been that quick." And finally she's called before the Senate or the Congress or some, you know, government deal. And they're saying, "No, come on, tell the truth. You know, nothing happened. And, you know, we measured it and we timed it." And she goes, "No, it really happened." "Well, can you prove it?" "No, I can't prove it. Is there any evidence? Is there any scientific evidence, any recording or measurement or anything to support, you know, your story?" "No, I've got nothing. It's just what I experienced, and I can't change. I guess it was a delusion, but I don't think it was." And then, anyway, long story short, she gets, you know, kind of hooks back with this pastor guy or priest, whatever he was, and the whole premise comes down to the point where faith is when you believe even when nobody believes you. You know, she had been challenging him for believing in this crazy thing called God. "Where's your evidence? Where's your proof?" "Well, I don't have any. I just know because I know. Because I've experienced it." Now she found herself in that same position. They're all telling her it couldn't have happened, it didn't happen. And she's saying, "Yeah, but it did happen. I know it happened." And even with the, you know, the testimony of her personal experience, because it couldn't be confirmed scientifically, no one would believe her. And that really hit the nail on the head for this passage. You know, we're going to, as we read this, I want you to take note of how many times we come across the word know, K-N-O-W, because this is about who knew what they knew, how they knew it, you know, if they knew it, and all that kind of thing. And again, the question comes back down to this: what do you need to know before you make that leap of faith? That leap of faith that says, "You know, I can't explain everything, I can't prove anything, but I'm just choosing to believe this thing because I know in my heart of hearts, I know that I know that I know that God is real and He loves for me and He cares for me." You know, what's it going to take? What do you need to know? What do you need to know before you give your life completely over to Jesus? And so I'm going to pose this study in the form of three big questions, and then we'll look into the answers of the questions. But first, let's read the passage starting in John chapter 7, verse 25. Let's back up just a little bit and set the stage. Jesus is in Jerusalem at the Feast of Tabernacles, and he came into town all alone, kind of on the sneak. Came in, you know, and didn't have an entourage with him and kept to himself. And I kind of, you know, in my mind's eye, I see him with the hood pulled up on his robe, you know, and kind of incognito. And then suddenly there he is in the temple courts and he begins to teach. We saw that in the last passage last week. And there are different groups of people. You know, there are the followers in general. There are the Jews, which refers to the religious leaders, the ones he's going to be arguing with. And then this one starts out, "Now some of them from Jerusalem." Now this whole thing is kind of keyed around the fact that sometime before this, Jesus had come to Jerusalem and healed a man at the pool of Bethsaida in such a way that everybody in Jerusalem knew about it. And then when the religious people heard about it, learned about it, they verified it. And then they said, "Well, this can't be a good thing because he did it on the wrong day of the week. This can't be from God. He did it on the wrong day." And so that's where their heads were at. Now he's talking about not necessarily his followers, not the religious leaders, but just some of the folks, sort of the witnesses, you know. You got to think about the people that lived in Jerusalem. It's one thing to be a Jew, not just genetically, but, you know, of the Jewish faith and live out in the countryside and go to the synagogue, the local synagogue with just a few people and, you know, open the Torah once a week and you didn't have your own Bible to read and that kind of thing. In Jerusalem, you know, it's headquarters. It's, I don't know, it's kind of like back in the 60s, living in Seattle, you couldn't help but get caught up in Boeing, you know? Or living out in Hillsboro and not be affected by the fact that Intel and Nike are out there. You know, everybody you know works for one or the other. And as a citizen of Jerusalem, you not only had your own religious heritage, but you were constantly, you know, just down, you could see the temple when you walked down the street, and there were priests and the high priest and these people everywhere. And so you can imagine what conversation was like at supper time, talking about, well, this rabbi said that, and did you hear what happened down there? And it all kind of, you know, was centered on the religious life in Jerusalem. And so now some of those folks from Jerusalem, is this not he whom they seek to kill? Well, just a minute ago in verse 19 or verse 17, 18, 19, Jesus has said, you know, I do one miracle and you seek to kill me. And in verse 20, they answered and said, you're out of your mind. Nobody's trying to kill you. And now, this kind of flipped that upside down. The people are going, well, isn't this the guy who they seek to kill? You know, they knew about this, about the Jewish leaders, this sort of buzz, this undercurrent of they want to take this guy out. But look, the people from Jerusalem say, he, Jesus, speaks boldly, and they say nothing to him. Do the rulers know indeed that this is truly the Christ? We know where this man is from, but when the Christ comes, no one knows where he's from. And then Jesus cried out as he taught in the temple, saying, now this is, cried out means he's not just talking to those that he was teaching. Suddenly he's making a proclamation for everybody within earshot. You both know me, and you know where I'm from. Interesting, some translations pose this verse as a question. You know me, and you know where I'm from, you know, and that kind of fits too. And I've not come of myself, but he who sent me is true, whom you do not know. But I know him, for I'm from him, and he sent me. And therefore they sought to take him, but no one laid a hand on him, because his hour had not yet come. And many of the people believed in him and said, when the Christ comes, will he do more signs than these which this man has done? Okay, let's back up and work through this. The first question, what do you need to know before you'll believe? You know, a strange fact, I guess, of human nature, the human condition, everyone really wants to believe. Everyone would like to believe. Even the unbelievers, if they're really honest, would say, you know, I wish I could believe in God. I don't. I feel like I can't, but I would like to. But just think about it. Everyone, believer, not believer, you know, rich, poor, young, old, in a moment of crisis, oh God. Oh, you know, you lose your job. Oh Lord, but I need you, Lord. You know, I need you to come and help me in this situation. In a moment of triumph, so, you know, you got the job. So thank you, Lord. You know, whether you mean it or not, it's just kind of an instinct. In a moment of tragedy, you lose a loved one, and it's always, Lord, why? Why him? Why her? Why now? Why in my life? Why did this have to happen? And I remember being an unbeliever and kind of driving down I-5 one day, and I was fiddling with the 8-track or something. Remember those? That's how long ago this was. I'm fiddling with the 8-track, skipping or something and warbling, and I'm monkeying with it, and I'm driving, and I get to work, and I looked up, and just all the traffic has stopped. Now, I was not a believer at the time. I don't know what I was. I was, you know, but the first words out of my mouth, I remember, oh God, as I slam on the brake, you know, and try not to crash into this two lanes of stop traffic on the freeways. There's just some kind of reflex in humans, even those that would, if they had a minute to think about it, would reject the Lord still. Oh God, you know, oh Lord, or thank you, Lord, you know, that kind of thing. There's something inside of everybody that wants to believe in God, to be able to call on him. Something in our nature tells us that that should be part of our existence. I don't know if you feel this way, but that's the same way I feel about being able to fly. There's something in my nature that says, you know, I should just be able to launch off and buzz around and zoom around, and I think in heaven we'll be able to do that. You know, these bodies won't be subject to gravity and all that. There's something, you know, I'm not saying that's how it's going to be, but there's something, and don't you feel that way? Isn't there just some part of deep in your nature where it just seems like it makes sense that you'd be able to do that? Well, it's that same kind of thing that just makes sense to you, your inner nature, that, you know, that there would be a God, that he would be there, that he would care, that he would be involved in your life, that he would interact with you and all of the above. And I think everybody has that. Now, you might think that people, you know, if people don't believe in God, then they believe in nothing. But it's worse. Because people that don't believe in God will believe in anything. Have you noticed that? You know, what's that old joke? I've got my lucky mood watch, you know, ring, karma thing, you know, on my wrist. I don't believe in all that mumbo jumbo, but my ring is yellow, which means, you know, which means your body temperature is approximately 80 degrees on the outside, is what that all that means. I guess the most common example I could think of to prove that point or illustrate it would be the idea of evolution. You know, people who don't believe in God will believe in anything, and evolution is a perfect example of that. I hope you realize that it takes a greater leap of faith to believe in evolution than it does to believe in biblical creation. It really does. Now, maybe you've never thought about it that way, but there's a choice to be made whether to believe it or not based on the evidence, and it's a bigger leap to accept evolution than it is to accept creation. You know, you realize that evolution is a theory. We call it the theory of evolution. It's based on several unsubstantiated assumptions. Darwin said way back then that eventually the fossil record would prove his theory. But you know what? More than 100 years after his death, there's not one speck of evidence for what they call the missing link, the idea that one species would somehow transition or evolve, you know, how lizards turned into birds and birds turned into mammals, or however that progression works. Not one piece of fossil evidence that supports that at all. The missing link, as they say, is still missing. But Genesis 1:24 says this: God created living creatures according to their kinds, livestock, creatures that move along the ground, and wild animals, each according to its kind, and it was so. And guess what? The fossil record bears that out exactly and perfectly, without exception. Science textbooks, probably the ones we use over here at the high school, refer to this creature called Pithecanthropus erectus. You might know him by the name Java Man. As far as I know, Java Man is still in the science textbooks, the high school science textbooks, but it has been quite a number of years since the remains of Java Man were proven to be those of a gibbon. You probably heard about Nebraska Man. The theory about Nebraska Man was based on a single tooth. Well, if the tooth looks like this, then the jaw it fits into must be like this. And then the skull that the jaw is part of must be like this. And the neck must, you know, the head bone connected to the neck bone, connected to the backbone. And pretty soon from a single tooth, you've got a whole guy, you know, Nebraska Man. And then somebody finally said, well, wait a minute, that tooth is from a pig. And it was. And it is. There is no Nebraska Man. It was, you know, but boy, they were sure of it. Evolution presupposes that, what do you say, everything, all stuff, moves from randomness and chaos into a state of order and organization. I like the way Chuck Missler says it. First there was nothing, and then it blew up. And that's the Big Bang, you know? But this idea of, you know, that what we're talking about here is the second law of thermodynamics, the law of entropy, which says exactly, it exactly contradicts Darwin's theory where things move from a random chaotic state to an organized state. The law of entropy says that things move from an organized state to a disassociated random state. And guess what? That law of thermodynamics can be proven by through scientific method. A repeatable experiment will demonstrate that. You've done that. You know, out here it's not unusual at all. I have yet to drive by one place that is kind of a pasture or a field, and then 50 years later, a barn suddenly materialized. But I've driven by lots of them where the barn that was brand new 50 years ago had suddenly disintegrated into a pile of lumber and you know, dust and dirt. That's the natural thing, and that's supported by the law of entropy, not the opposite. And so again, the question, what do you need to know? What is it that you need to know before you will believe? Now, these folks in Jerusalem, they thought that they needed to know where the Messiah comes from. They thought they knew that, actually, and they thought they knew about Jesus. Look again at the end of verse 26. Do the rulers know indeed that this is truly the Christ? You know, they're saying, wow, have the priests had a secret meeting and concluded that this is the Messiah? You know, he's out here in the temple speaking boldly, and they said they wanted to arrest him, but they're not lifting a finger against him. Have they changed their minds? Have they kind of come to this other conclusion? However, verse 27, we know where this man is from. They thought they knew he was from Galilee. But when the Christ comes, you know, when the real Christ comes, no one will know where he's from. You know, the rabbis had three sayings. This is from the Midrash, or one of those rabbinic, you know, non-biblical but rabbinic texts. And the rabbis said that three things come wholly unexpected. You know, there are three things that are always a big surprise. One is the Messiah. The second is a godsend. The third one is a scorpion. You know, three things that you just stumble onto without expecting, you know, just as you would step on a scorpion without seeing it or meaning to, or stumble onto a godsend, you know, you look down and there was $100 bill. I don't know where it came from. I just stumbled onto it, you know, or, you know, number three, of course, the Messiah. These things would just appear suddenly. Now, part of that may be based on their understanding of Malachi chapter 3. Turn back to Malachi. It's the last book in the Old Testament, so it's going to be right before Matthew. Malachi chapter 3. And maybe, this is speculation, but maybe their expectations of the Messiah, or the arrival of the Messiah, were based on this. Malachi 3:1. Behold, I send my messenger, and he will prepare the way before me. So far, does it sound familiar? Remind you of John the Baptist, maybe? And the Lord whom you seek will suddenly come to his temple. Well, they were seeking the Messiah. The Lord who they were seeking, Malachi says, will come suddenly to his temple. Now, they took that as a literal prophecy. And so whenever, however, wherever, whoever, it'll happen when he just, boom, he's there 1 minute, and it won't be in Nazareth. It'll be in the temple. And so based on that expectation, well, we know where this guy's from. And when the Christ comes suddenly into the temple, as Malachi said, nobody will know where he's from. Funny thing is that in a sense, Jesus did come out of nowhere. He came from Nazareth. You know, can anything good come out of Nazareth? I guess that's about as nowhere as you can get in that sense. And he had appeared suddenly. And he had appeared unexpectedly, but they thought they knew what to look for, but turns out they didn't know what to look for because the real thing was right there before them. They were already, excuse me, already way off track. You know, how could they say, as they do in verse 27, when the Messiah comes, when the Messiah is right there in front of them? Scripture is pretty clear about where the Messiah comes from. If you look back in Matthew chapter 2, we find a quotation from Micah chapter 5, but we'll just read the one from Matthew chapter 2, verses 4 and 6, or 4 through 6, excuse me. And this has to do with the Christmas story. You'll recognize this. When he, that is Herod, had gathered all the chief priests and scribes of the people together, he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. So they said to him, "In Bethlehem of Judah, for thus it is written by the prophet, 'But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are not the least among the rulers of Judah, for out of you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel.'" So this is, you know, the wise men came, and there wasn't just three of them, but that's another discussion. But the wise men came, "We're here to worship the king." And Herod said, "Really? What king is that?" "Well, the king of the Jews. The stars tell us that he's born, you know." And so he said, "Well, come back later, we'll talk about it." And he said, "Where is this other king?" And they said, "Well, everybody knows Micah, you know, in you, Bethlehem Ephrata," translated here, "you, Bethlehem of Judah." You know, that's where the Messiah was going to be born. And they knew that he'd be born in just Bethlehem. Well, guess what? Jesus was born in Bethlehem, even though they didn't know that. And then for a time, his family moved to Egypt to escape the slaughter that Herod ordered. You know the Sunday school story about Herod orders the murder of all the little boys 2 years old and younger in Bethlehem, because one of them, according to that prophecy that his own guys just quoted him, was going to be the king of the Jews, and one of them was. But Jesus and his family were warned in a dream and escaped to Egypt. And then after Herod died, they came back to Israel, fulfilling what's in Hosea 11:1, "Out of Egypt I called my son." What they needed to know was in fact true. That was the case, but they didn't know it. And what they thought they knew, what they were banking their eternity on, was a mistake, was a false understanding. They didn't know. Funny, when Jesus and his family came back to Israel, or from Egypt, they settled in Nazareth. And one of the Gospels quotes this Old Testament prophecy, "He will be termed a Nazarene." Now, if you look for that verse, well, you know, which Old Testament prophet said that? None of them. You won't find that in your Bible. And that got my attention as I was looking at this thing, you know, inductively. And I came to find out that this word that they translated Nazarene is a word that, It's a whole lot like the Hebrew word for a branch, the kind that you throw in the burn pile. And it's kind of a word of contempt. Now, I don't know if they intended it to be understood that way, but "he'll be called a Nazarene" is not a reference to the fact that he was from Nazareth. It's more of a coincidence, but the idea that he would be from Nowheresville, from the trash pile, from the burn pile, that's more of an accurate understanding of that verse. But see, they disqualified Jesus as even a possible Messiah because of an error in their understanding. And if they had really known where he was from, then they would have known that he was the Messiah, and they would have believed. So what is it that you need to know before you believe? You know, what if your expectations have been fulfilled? You just don't know about it. What if whatever it is you're waiting for has already happened? You just haven't heard about it. What if whatever you're looking for is already here? You know, are you seeking the Lord in the abnormal and totally failing to see him in the ordinary? Are you waiting for the Lord to visit you personally and missing the fact that he's here all the time, everywhere, in everything? In the heart of every person is the desire to know God, and every person can know God. In fact, the Bible says God has been made plain. If you'll turn up a couple of chapters to Romans chapter 1, there's a couple of verses here. Actually, it's quite a chunk in the last half of the first chapter. We studied this a couple of years ago, but in this context, it just, the harmony of the different books of the Bible is just, you know, amazing. So if we start in Romans 1:18, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Because although they knew God, they didn't glorify him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools, changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man and birds and four-footed animals and creeping things, talking about the idols that were worshipped. Therefore, because of all that, God also gave them up to uncleanness in the lusts of their hearts, to dishonor their bodies among themselves. They exchanged the truth of God for the lie. And notice it says the lie. That's the problem, the big lie. And worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. For this reason, God gave them up to vile passions. For even their women exchanged the natural use for what is against nature. Likewise also the men, leaving the natural use of the woman, burned in their lust for one another. Men with men, committing what is shameful and receiving in themselves the penalty of their error, which was due. And even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a debased mind to do those things which are not fitting, being filled with all unrighteousness, sexual immorality, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, strife, evil-mindedness. They are whisperers, backbiters, haters of God, violent, proud, boasters, inventors of evil things, disobedient to parents. Did you expect to see that in the list? Undiscerning, untrustworthy, unloving, unforgiving, unmerciful, who, knowing the righteous judgment of God, that those who practice such things are deserving of death, not only do the same, and death, by the way, is not just physical death, but spiritual death, eternal separation from God, not only do the same, but also approve of those who practice them. Man, this was written about 56 or 57 A.D., and it sounds like something out of today's newspaper, doesn't it? What more do you need to know before you believe? And if you consider yourself a born-again believer, saved by grace, washed in the blood, and all the rest, then the second big question that this passage answers is, what do you need to know, believer, before you give your life completely over to Jesus? Rather than dabbling in faith, what's it take for you to give your life completely over to the Lord? These people in Jerusalem on this day, they thought they knew what they were doing. Verse 28, and Jesus cried out as he taught in the temple, you know me, you know who I am, and you know where I'm from. And in my translation it says and, I think a but works better, but I've not come of myself, but I've come, but from he who sent me, and he who sent me is true, whom you don't know, but I know him, for I'm from him, and he sent me. See, they thought he was from Nazareth, but he wasn't from Nazareth. In fact, Jesus is not even saying he's from Bethlehem. He's saying, I come from the Father. That's where Messiah comes from. Their knowledge was false. They were mistaken. They didn't know the truth about him. And here they were making these eternal decisions based on misinformation and bad understanding and lack of facts, really. Now, we don't have that problem. We know everything that they didn't know. We know that Jesus fulfilled over 300 prophecies, not just generally in kind of a broad sense, but specific things that, the odds of one person alone fulfilling them all is astronomical. The odds of two or more are, twice astronomical. We know about the virgin birth. We know that it was in Bethlehem. We know about him moving to Egypt and then coming back to Nazareth. We know about the signs, the miracles, the wonders. We know about the cross. We know about the resurrection. We know that God made him who knew no sin to be sin for us so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. We know all that, that they didn't know. What do you need to know, believer, before you give your life completely over to Jesus? I read a fable. These dogs were having a discussion about who could run the fastest. And one dog said, "Well, I can run faster than any rabbit, no problem." I said, "Really? Think so?" "Yeah. Oh, done it 100 times, not a problem." And so they set him up. Well, here's the dog. There's the rabbit. Go get him. And the dog ran with everything he had. You know, it's like one of our dogs. They run so fast that their back legs get in front of their front legs, and you think they're going to flip, turn inside out or something. I mean, just running, and the rabbit zoomed away, got away, and he came back, and he's real embarrassed now. The dog is, he's been made a fool of, and his friends are going to ridicule him and all the rest. And he says, "Well, just remember one thing. The rabbit was running for his life. I was just running for dinner." And I get that. I mean, you've never run so fast until you've had to run away from the police, Just not that I've ever. No. I've never been under arrest or incarcerated or anything like that. I should have been probably, but I never. But that's kind of a question, the same question, really. Are you running for your life when it comes to living in the fullness of the life that Jesus died to make available to you? Or are you just running for dinner? And what's it going to take to make the difference? What do you need to know before you give yourself, your life, completely to him? Only as you give your life completely to Jesus can you operate in the power of the Lord. In the peace, for example, that comes with the confidence that Jesus models for us here. Look in verse 30. "Therefore, they sought to take him." That's it. Let's get him. "But no one laid a hand on him." Why? Because he knew kung fu, because he was, what's that guy, Jackie Chan, who can run up the wall and all that kind of stuff? No one laid a hand on him because his hour had not yet come. This takes us back a few weeks. He was living according to God's timetable, and he knew that. He knew he was. He knew what the timetable was. He knew that this wasn't the day to be arrested and tried and crucified, and so he was able to speak boldly, surrounded by spiritual enemies. They tried to get him, but they didn't, because it wasn't his time. And many of the people, it says, believed in him. And this is a word that means real faith. And they said, when the Christ comes, if this isn't the Christ, then when the real Christ comes, is he going to do more signs than these which this man has done? A life given over completely to the Lord. That's what Jesus models here. Yeah, threat, you might have fought, you might have ran, you might have screamed for help, whatever. Jesus just, as that time in Nazareth, they took him to throw him off the cliff, and he just kind of shrugged him off and walked right through the crowd. They probably didn't know what happened. His hour had not yet come, because he's not just a man. He's from God. And when you live that in that kind of confidence, a life given completely over to the Lord is a life of joyful obedience. Not toe the line or else, but just, "Lord, how can I serve you? What can I surrender? What can I sacrifice? What can I do that's maybe kind of stretches my comfort zone a little bit? What would you have me do, Lord? Whatever it is, I'll do it." Joyful obedience. It's a life that's filled with rest. The rest and the peace and the confidence that comes with the knowledge that you're living out God's perfect plan for you specifically. It's a life of knowing that even when bad things happen, and they will, because we live in a polluted, infected world, and as long as we're on planet Earth, we're going to get some of that. There's just no way around it. But when you know that, you also know that in all things, God works for the good of those who love him, who've been called according to his purpose. So what do you need to know, believer, to make that the reality in your life? And then the last question that's addressed in this passage, what do you need to know so that you'll act before it's too late? What do you need to know before it's too late? Look at verse 33 or verse 32. The Pharisees heard the crowd murmuring these things concerning him, and the Pharisees and the chief priests sent officers to take him. This would be the temple police, not the Roman soldiers, the temple police, to take him. And Jesus said to them, I'll be with you a little while longer, and then I go to him who sent me. You'll seek me and not find me, and where I am, you can't come. And then the Jews said among themselves, where does he intend to go that we won't find him? Does he intend to go to the dispersion? You know, does he intend to go to the Jews that are scattered out around the, you know, outside beyond Israel, among the Greeks, and to teach even the Greeks, the Gentiles? What is this thing that he said, you will seek me and not find me, and where I am, you cannot come? You know, the point here is that Jesus said there will come a time when you'll look for me and you won't find me. Matthew records this. Jesus once said, ask and it'll be given to you. Seek and you'll find. Knock and the door will be opened to you. But right here he's saying that there will be a day when those who seek will not find. They will not find him. Now this is beautifully illustrated in the story of Esau and Jacob. It's in the stories in Genesis 25. You might want to find Genesis 27 because in a minute I am going to want to read a couple verses from that. In the meantime, I'll just kind of tell you a rough version of the story. I hope you remember Esau and Jacob were brothers, twin brothers, although they aren't very twin-like. Esau is a sportsman and a man's man, an outdoorsman. He hunts, he fishes, he kills and cleans, and, you know, he's hairy. I mean, he's just a rough kind of guy. But he comes in from the hunt one day and he's so hungry, he wants what he wants right now. And to get it, he trades the incredible riches of his birthright, the inheritance from his father as the oldest son, for a bowl of soup. I'm starving, Jacob. You got give me some of that soup you're making. And Jacob, you know, dirty, sneaky thief, you know, the usurper, the heel snatcher, says, well, I'll give you a bowl of soup if you give me your birthright. And Esau, in his mind, he's thinking, yeah, birthright, schmirthright, I'm hungry. Sure, you can have it, whatever, take it. He didn't appreciate it. And for instant gratification of his physical appetite, he traded off the blessings of a rich future. He chose to run for his dinner, literally, not for his life. And you can see how he felt when he finally came to seek that blessing from his father in Genesis 27, starting in verse 30. Now it happened as soon as Isaac had finished blessing Jacob, and Jacob, you know, Jacob received that birthright, and Jacob had scarcely gone out from the presence of Isaac, his father, that Esau, his brother, came in from his hunting. He also had made some savory food, brought it to his father, and said to his father, let my father arise and eat of his son's game, that your soul may bless me. His father Isaac said, who are you? He said, well, I'm your son. I'm your firstborn. You know, I'm Esau. And Isaac trembled exceedingly and said, who? Where's the one who hunted game and brought it to me? It was Jacob on the sneak there. I ate all of it before you came, and I have blessed him, and indeed he shall be blessed. You know, it can't be and won't be undone. Now in Hebrews, the writer of Hebrews tells part of this story and he describes this situation. I mean, let me just review a little bit. You know, birthright, schmirthright, I'm hungry and I want some soup now. Yeah, birthright, I don't care, you can have it, give me that soup. And then finally he wants the birthright and he can't have it because it's already been given to the brother that he gave it to, as unfair as the whole thing might seem. And now he's throwing a fit. I want my birthright. And then Hebrews puts it this way. Afterward, as you know, when he wanted to inherit this blessing, he was rejected. He could bring about no change of mind, though he sought the blessing with tears. It was too late. It was over. You know, it ain't over till it's over, but when it's over, it's really, really over. Or I like it better this way. It's never too late until it's too late, and then it's too late. And it's never too late to seek the Lord until it's too late, and then it's too late. Do you realize that the Lord could come back for the church any day, any minute, any second? You might not have a chance, another chance. The evidence is there, the anecdotal evidence, the scientific evidence, the historical evidence, the geological evidence, archaeological evidence, historical evidence, it's all there. But what's it going to take for you to make that decision before it's too late? That one day the trumpet is going to blow, talks about in Thessalonians, and the church will be caught up in the air to meet him. And then it's going to be too late. You can't say, oh, okay, I changed my mind. You can't be Esau and say, but I didn't mean to give it away. I didn't mean to trade forever for this pleasure right here, right now. God forbid, you might not make it home from church today. And then it's going to be too late. Man, it's been a couple of years now, a few years, but we had a fella who was here at church with us. And he went home that day, and that afternoon he was murdered. It was in all the papers. You had to hear about it. Nobody knew he was here that day, but he was. Now, I don't know this fella. I don't know much about him. I know what they say about him, and only God knows the heart, and I really don't have any basis to make any kind of opinion or judgment. But I do know that if he had a chance here to really repent of sin and give his life to the Lord but didn't, man, later that day, it was too late. Now, that hurts my heart. It ought to hurt yours. What do you need to know before you believe? What do you need to know before you give your life completely over to Jesus? What do you need to know before it's too late? 2 Corinthians 6:2 says, in the time of my favor, I heard you, and in the day of salvation, I helped you. This is the Lord speaking. I tell you, now is the time of God's favor. Now is the day of salvation. That was written by the Apostle Paul. When are you going to start thinking like Paul and consider everything rubbish, as he wrote in Philippians chapter 3, compared to the surpassing greatness of knowing Christ Jesus? What do you need to know? What else? What more do you need to know for you to decide to live in the reality of God's grace, God's mercy, God's kindness, and God's love for you?